For the remainder of our program, we're going to be featuring the works of Gene Shepherd. His book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, and commentaries that he did for another radio network in 1982 and 1983. Someone recently wrote to me an email asking me if I had those commentaries. Well, apparently they were released once, probably as a premium for that other radio network. Well, guess what? We're resurrecting them here now as a premium for this radio network, the Pacifico Corporation and WBAI New York, a proud part of said network. Yes, it's our summer. What's see? Yeah, summer. That's right. Let me stick my head out the window and see what this season is. It's the summer emergency fund drive here at WBAI. Yes, layoffs coming on the 1st of August, cutbacks, and so we thought we might come on the air and ask some of our serious listeners and supporters to help us out to pay the outstanding creditors and perhaps avoid a layoff or two, or furlough, and that's the new term for a layoff. Instead of laying people off, we'll just give them an enforced non-paid month or two vacation. That's the way to deal with the economic crisis, or we could do what we do most often. I was going to say best, but that's hardly the word for what we do here, which is go on the air and ask our listeners for support, because after all, it's a listener-sponsored radio station founded on the principle that if you put on good radio programming that people will want to hear, they will be willing to shell out to keep the radio station on the air. And also commercial free. So that's what we're doing here this morning. It's a 10-day event, and this is the only time in August, or what is this, July. We won't be doing this again in earnest until September, when the September drive rolls around. This is just the emergency summer fun drive pushed up from August to July, because that's how badly we need the money right now. I'll try not to sound as glib, because this is serious. We need some listener dollars. The premiums this morning, in case you would like to get something for your donations to WBAI, all we ask is $25 for a full year regular membership. You know, we know how difficult it is to get people to give something for nothing, they think. You know, I subscribe to Sirius Satellite Radio because there's a program on there that I like to listen to. Of course, I can't listen to Sirius Satellite Radio until I pay up front. You even got to go buy their stinking radio, and then you have to pay a subscription for that radio. And as a matter of fact, if you get a second radio, your subscription isn't good. You got to get a subscription for each radio. So if you have one in your car and one in your home, for example, you got to pay them twice. You got to subscribe twice. Well, that's one business model. WBAI has a ridiculous business model. We just go ahead with the programming. And then we, a couple of times a year, we ask you to pay for it because you listen to it. Television and commercial radio do it through selling your ears and your time to advertisers. So while you're listening to, left-wing network that has commercial breaks every 3 minutes? Air America, is that what it's called? I don't know. I can't even listen to it because of the frequent and lengthy commercial breaks therein. Well, you have none of that here at WBAI, as you well know. Instead, we take month-long commercial breaks when we do mixed programming and fundraising. Which means that between now and 6 o'clock, half of what you hear will be me asking for you to call 212-209-2950. That's the number to make a pledge to WBAI, 212-209-2950, and pay for what you've been listening to. You can also do it online at WBAI.org. WBAI.org. You can actually pledge now for the shows that you listen to. If you want to make a dedicated contribution to your favorite program, you can do it now at WBAI.org. Some of the premiums are up there as well, but I don't think we have any of the new stuff up there just yet. So you might want to call in 212-209-2950. And we have two new premiums for you, two new Gene Shepherd premiums this morning. One of them, gee, I should have explained this to the tally guy before I come on the air with it, shouldn't I have? But, you know, no one's going to call for at least an hour, so we're safe. Of course, if you want to prove me wrong, 212-209-2950 and support WBAI. The $30 premium, the practically free premium, the premium that only we only charge enough extra to mail it to you premium, is a one-hour tape of 22 commentaries, mostly from 2 minutes to 3 minutes. There's a couple of longer pieces, a tribute to Arthur Godfrey that we'll listen to this morning, as well as a feature on the opening of A Christmas Story that occurred while Shepherd was a commentator on the National Public Radio Network. But there are 22 total commentaries. It's a little over an hour, and that's a CD, which can be yours for a $30 pledge. You become a member of WBAI, and you also get this wonderful CD. Now, for $125, we have something new. We did offer it once before, but it wasn't unmasked backwards, so no one knew anything about it. It's a 7-CD reading done by Gene Shepherd himself in 1969 of his first book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, from cover to cover. This is not that series of recordings that he did well into his dotage in the late 80s. No, this is Shepherd reading the book cover to cover, and it's 7 CDs, and we're letting you have that for a mere $125 pledge. Ridiculous, I know. Because if we use the formula that they like to use for premiums, this one would cost you $300. But we're letting it go for $125, a 7-CD set. Shepherd reading his own book in 1969. It was released in 67 or thereabouts. So that's what we're offering to you this morning in the way of premiums. And you can take advantage of either one of those at any time by calling 212-209-2950. And I should say, well, the NPR commentaries, you can get other places. I'm not going to say you can't, but the In God We Trust reading, nobody has that but me. It's been withdrawn from its original source and has been for the last 20 years or more. It was redone by someone else. But this is taken from the actual studio master. Unfortunately, it was taken by way of cassette, so it's not super crisp, clear studio sound, but it's darn close, and it's better than any other copy you would find if you could find one. We'll listen to a story later on in the program, but I want to go to some of these commentaries right now from the other radio network. As soon as I find the folder that has them in it. Faster than sound, wow. All right. God damn. I don't know who configures these computers, but God. Well, what do you want to hear? Here's a good trio. We'll hear three in a row. First one being a 4th of July story. Second one being about decorative lawn ornaments. And the third about Shepherd's favorite baseball team. Three commentaries in a row from Gene Shepherd, 1983. This is Mass Backwards on WBAI. And I have no doubt that in any second, Windows Media Player will spring to life. Or will it? In the meantime, 212-209-2950 to make a pledge to WBAI.
It's private memories that make holidays special, moments apart from preordained parades and speeches. Storyteller Gene Shepherd recalls such a moment when the world engraved itself deeply upon him. He was 5 years old.
I can recall being out in the backyard of our house, and it was the 4th of July. And he knew it was the 4th of July because people were shooting off firecrackers and everything all around me. When all of a sudden there was this deep rumble in the air. and it was hot. This was outside of Chicago in northern Indiana. And when it's July in northern Indiana, the heat comes rolling down those long prairies like a vast tidal wave of nothing but pure misery, bringing with it millions and billions and trillions of mosquitoes. And you can smell the lake about maybe 3 or 4 miles to the north with its dead perch and its detergent coating. Anyway, it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and hot, and I'm a kid. I'm out there in the backyard fooling around with a clothespin or something, when all of a sudden there's this deep rumble in the air, just a sort of rolling sound. And it sounded like something coming closer. And people started to come out of their houses. I remember Mrs. Bruner next door in her apron coming out. She weighed 400 pounds, and she came thundering out on the back porch looking up. And my mother came out. They were hearing this thing, too. When suddenly, over the top of our house, it seemed to come, was this fantastic silver shape. It covered the whole sky. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen, and it just slowly drifted over the backyards of Indiana. It was this tremendous dirigible, or do you prefer dirigible? It was one of the great zeppelins of the world making a visit to Chicago for the 4th of July. Chicago was about 30 miles north of us. And this magnificent thing just hung in the air. It looked like it stretched from the horizon to the horizon. You could see the flashing silver propellers and just the deep throb, boom, 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 of its engines. It was truly a magical sight. It was like seeing a great silver gossamer yacht or something in the air. And then a few firecrackers went off and somebody shot off a skyrocket that looked unbelievably puny, with that great silver beautiful thing drifting over us. And ever since that time, that has always been the fourth to me, the silver shadow drifting over Chicago and the cornfields of Indiana in the tremendous heat of July. This is Gene Shepherd for National Public Radio.
All things considered, commentator Gene Shepherd is less concerned with the height of people's lawns than what people put on them.
One time when I was in college, I had this book that I had to read for an assignment, you know, the kind that you just barely can get through. But one line stuck out and has remained in my mind ever since. It's about the only thing I can actually remember learning in college. In this novel, the writer said that that brief moment between night and full dawn, everything comes clear to the human mind. And you know, this is true. I actually had that happen to me the other night, or the other morning, or the other dawn, or the other instant. What is it, that moment between dawn and sunrise and night and blackness? I'm driving along in my car through a little town in Jersey, Hackensack, actually, at these little lawns, you know, these little houses. And it's just about getting to be dawn. I'm the only car on the road. And suddenly there is a red light telling me to stop. I'm the only car. So I stopped. And I could hear the stoplight ticking. You know, they tick when there's no traffic noise or any other kind of noise. They go sort of a tick, 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 like some kind of a secret electronic bomb. This thing was ticking away. And all of a sudden I said to myself, why am I stopping for a light bulb? This light bulb has commanded me to stop. I'm a machine. And I continue to sit there. Such is the ingrained reliance on law in Western man. And then I became aware that something was looking at me. I felt eyes peering at me. I looked over my shoulder, and there, over on a lawn, off to my right, was this figure standing on the lawn in the gloom, in that curious moment when all things come clear to the mind. And they sure did. It was a concrete Mexican standing on the lawn. And he was wearing a little concrete hat, you know, the kind, the big sombrero, and he had a concrete serape, and he was leading a concrete donkey. And he just looked at me with a big smile. A concrete Mexican on a lawn in Hackensack. Well, the light turned green. I put the car into first, and I started to crawl out
moving away across the intersection, and I could feel his eyes following me down the street. And then I had this sudden insight. I think we're the only people in the world to put concrete people on their lawns, especially concrete Mexicans. And then I thought, again, a little further jump in thinking, I could see a little adobe hut outside of Mexico City, and right there next to the cactus, and right next to that great big brass pot that they have next to the front door, is a little concrete New Jerseyite standing there in front of his concrete Pinto, holding a concrete martini, a salute to the fellow American, wherever he might be, north, south, or central. That moment between dawn and night, the mind evolves clear images of what is. Be careful. Sleep through it, or you're liable to get into trouble. This is Gene Shepherd for National Public Radio.
Series underway, there is at least one baseball fan who is not rooting for the Baltimore Orioles or the Philadelphia Phillies. Commentator Gene Shepherd's favorite team almost made it to the series, but he takes comfort that the Chicago Southsiders are, if nothing else, consistent.
The White Sox have a pot that looks like a cave that was stolen from Kentucky. And late at night, you can smell the remains of what used to be the stockyards drifting in over second base. Well, year after year after year, I followed the White Sox just like my father before me. And year after year, the White Sox, at the end of the year, were sixth place, fifth place, once in a while second place, oh, rarely, most likely eighth, ninth place. And if there were 10th and 15th places, they would have been there. The White Sox got into the league playoff this year. And I'm delighted to report that my stable rock on which my life is based is still inviolable. They booted it. Booted it, booted it, booted it. In fact, their top slugger stood there with the bat on his shoulder and watched three strikes go by him three consecutive times at the plate. A classic White Sox clutch performance. Made me feel warm watching it. Incidentally, when was the last time the White Sox ever won the World Series? Well, I'll tell you. Baron von Richthofen, the Red Baron, had just completed his 60th victory over the Western Front. The year was 1917, and after that point, generation after generation of failure, sparked only by the Black Sox. The White Sox, you know, are the only team that were ever actually proven to have thrown a World Series. And my father, who lived on the south side of Chicago, back of the yards, claims that as a child, he was actually outside the ballpark when Shoeless Joe Jackson, the famous Chicago White Sox outfielder of the period, was heard to say to the crowd, "I'm sorry," at which point a little urchin leaped out of the crowd and uttered a phrase which has entered baseball lore. He said, "Say it ain't so, Joe." My old man claims he heard it. He was there, apocryphal or not. So today I feel sound and solid. The basic stability of my life remains. The White Sox did not get into the World Series again this year. And I, for one, am glad. For National Public Radio, this is Gene Shepherd.
And for Pacifica Radio, I'm Max Mead, asking you to support listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI, and get a CD with 22 of commentaries like the ones we've just heard for a $30 pledge of support to WBAI. I'd be happy to send it along. If you would care to make a $30 pledge, $25 makes you a member. And the remaining $5 goes to the cost of manufacturing and mailing that CD to you. So, 212-209-2950 is the number to call with your support to WBAI and in support of Mass Backwards, in support of the fact that we've been bringing you Gene Shepherd for about a dozen years here to great acclaim. And I'm aware that many of you are listening to this program, perhaps through time management, meaning you're listening in one archive or another. I want you to go online to WBAI.org and make your donation there. I'm going to see if I can't get these premiums up. They're not now. I think you may find some other Gene Shepherd stuff up there from the past. But do make a pledge one way or the other, either online or right now live in person. 212-209-2950. What did we just listen to? Let me give you the details. Okay, that was the July 4th, 1983 program about the blimp over Shepherd's House on the 4th of July. We also heard the Concrete Mexican on the Hackensack Lawn from July 11th, 1983. And the White Sox failure from October 12th of 1983. Three of 22 commentaries with a $30 pledge to WBAI. Now we will be listening to a complete story from our other premium, the complete reading by Gene Shepherd of In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. For a $125 pledge, you're going to get, it's about 8 hours long, the reading. It covers seven CDs for $125. Now, I can't combine these, as we have in the past, because, you know, if you got the In God We Trust set, that's already seven CDs. You want the eighth CD, you'll have to kick in an extra 30. I'm sorry. That's just the way it goes. Well, we've got the high-end for you high-end types, the few of you that listen to this program, and we've got the $30 Come One, Come All pledge, and many of Shepherd's classic stories and commentaries are included. He talks about movies, modern movies, talks about TV news, bumper stickers on cars, pickle lovers, Slob Appeal, Spring Training, Spring Fever, an Arthur Godfrey Memorial, Compulsive Reading, Football Spectators Wearing Masks, Shepherd Bored by the Film Gandhi, and who wouldn't be? Summer's Coming, Don't Blow It This Year Like You Have Every Other Years, Car Names, Shep on Old Time Radio, Shep on Howard Johnson, Cookbooks by Famous Writers, White Castle, How to Use a Top, and more. 22 commentaries from 1983 for a $30 pledge to WBAI to keep this place afloat. Yes, the painful measures to balance the budget and to attempt to live within our means are mere days away. Come August 1st, draconian measures will be taken against certain members of the staff, as yet unnamed. Layoffs and furloughs are in the offing for the staff of WBAI. And that's why we're coming to you with this emergency appeal for 10 days. We're actually halfway through it or more. It's going to run through Saturday. If you can come down and volunteer at any time, day or night, 24 hours between now and Saturday. We can always use help answering phones, or we have just one person here now who's doing tally and answering telephones. There was a call coming in. So, if at any point two calls come in at the same time, we're going to be in a bit of a pickle because there's only one person answering phones and nobody else here in the station. So, when you decide to call, this would be a good time because there is no caller on the line now. You could be the one and only person supporting Mass Backwards. If you call now, 212-209-2950. Don't wait until someone else is calling. There'll be a log jam. We also especially urge you to put it on a credit card or a debit card for a number of reasons. Number one reason, we'll have the money in a day or two. That's a very good reason. But number two, there's no extra paperwork and postage. We won't have to bill you. You won't have to remember to write a check. It's all taken care of when you pledge on a credit card, so we really urge you to do that. And there's another call, 212-209-2950. Someone has pledged $25. That's the basic membership rate. You become a member for a full year, but of course we will accept any amount you can afford, any amount you feel this program is worth over the course of a year. Now, a $25 pledge, this person values this program to tune of 50 cents a week. Yes, and that's more than they pay me, more than 50 cents a week. However, if you'd like to get the CD with the 22 NPR commentaries from 1983, a $30 pledge will make you a member and give you that CD. For a $125 pledge, don't forget, we are offering the complete reading by Gene Shepherd of In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. This was done at the height of his radio career, sometime in the early 1969. He read this. It was distributed to certain people who couldn't read a book by certain organizations devoted to readings for people who couldn't read books. They withdrew it a few years later and had someone else read it. I don't even know if that one is still available for listening. But the Shepherd one has long been withdrawn. It sits in a vault, just like all of his TV shows that you can't get anywhere. Except here, and only as a thank you gift for your pledge to WBAI. 212-209-2950. There's one call on the line. And, well, that's a rate of one call every 3 minutes. That's not bad. That's about how long it takes to fill out that pledge card. So, you could call. Would be your turn next. And then, you know, if we get one call every 3 minutes, that's, gee, it's about 15 calls between now and 6 o'clock. That would be a good pace. I can stand it. 212-209-2950. To pay the rent, to pay the electric bills, to pay the staff, whose salaries have been cut by four-fifths. No, by one-fifth. Pardon me. That's right. 2 years ago, the last time we had financial difficulties, we all took a whack of one-fifth. Some people, like my department head, took a whack of one-half. Believe it or not, the operations department is run by a half-time employee here at WBAI. Other people get bonuses, but no. Department heads get whacked in half, and the staff gets whacked to four-fifths. Who knows how they're going to whack us this time in 3 days on August 1st. I understand the people we ordinarily pay to run tally are working for free. That's their donation, this fund drive. All we're asking from you, and you know, if you have a job, $25 is a paltry figure, I would say. Certainly anyone can afford that. And if you tune in regularly to this program, it certainly is worth $25 a year for your support, isn't it? I think so. 212-209-2950. That's the number to call. We have one call on the line. We could use one more. Now, before 5 o'clock, or around 5 o'clock, I want to go to a full story from In God We Trust, and we'll coast home on more NPR commentaries. We'd like to see the tally go up a little bit. Okay, someone, looks like someone has pledged for the $30 CD of these NPR commentaries from 1983. Maybe you need a taste of In God We Trust to decide if you would like to have the entire book read by Gene Shepherd. You know, it's a book I've put off reading all these years. I've read stories from it. I've read sections of it. I haven't sat down and read it cover to cover. If you're like me, you'd be more inclined, perhaps, to listen to it. And why not have, you know, listen to it in the author's own words, in the author's own voice? For a $125 pledge, you can do just that. Hear Gene Shepherd read his own first novel, Well, he called it a novel. I don't know if anyone else would. Collection of short stories, many of them previously printed in Playboy. Many of them Comedy Award winners in Playboy magazine, and a good portion of them converted into movies such as A Christmas Story. 212-209-2950. We can bill you, but we urge you to use a credit card, Visa, MasterCard, American Express. Your debit card should work. Ah, here we go. Here's one that's all cut up. Let me find a medium-length story for you. Yes, I'm looking through some of the chapters of In God We Trust. Such stories as Miss Breyfogle and the amazing case, the frightening case of the speckle-throated cuckold. There's one story. It's 35 minutes long. Nevermore, quoth the assessor, nevermore. You know, that may be the perfect one to play. Or did we already play that once? We probably did. But that won't stop me. Let's see. Something screwy with the computer readout. Let me see if this even comes up. It's not showing me a file type. Ugh, look at that. How bizarre. It's lost its file type. Let me give it a file type. Now let's see if it comes up.
Nevermore.
Ah, there we go.
Mr. Poe's
All right, we're going to fade out the music of Little Rascals. We're going to tell you that you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York. And we're going to hear the Gene Shepherd story. Nevermore, quoth the assessor, nevermore. Keep the wolves from the door. Call 212-209-2950 while the story is on. I'm Max Schmid. This is Mass Backwards this morning featuring Gene Shepherd as part of our summer emergency fundraising drive. Hoping to hear from more of you with calls of support as you listen to Gene Shepherd.
Chapter 28. Nevermore, quoth the assessor, nevermore. Mr. Poe's sinister, beady-eyed raven has always been a figure of great speculation and conjecture among literary analysts. How did Poe come up with such an eerie apparition? What did it mean? What was the source of this evil bird? In what dark, cluttered, moldy recess of Poe's mind did it live? Why? It said little, just bleakly stared, a hooded angel of death and destruction and God knows what. Any resident of northern Indiana of a certain benighted period in history could tell you in spades where Poe got his raven. The banshee wind rattling the eaves, murky shapes lurking in the gathering gloom, those gleaming, inhuman, all-seeing eyes could mean only one thing. Unquestionably, somewhere along the line, Poe must have run afoul of an Indiana personal property tax assessor. Even at this remove, the very word, assessor, sends thin, jangling squeaks of fear through many a Hoosier nervous system. One sure way to clear the streets of random mankind in an Indiana hamlet is simply to bellow at the top of your voice, "The assessor is coming!" Instantly, a palpable wave of chill dread causes doors to slam, windows to darken, and souls to quake. The Indiana personal property tax was very personal. In theory, it was also very basic and simple. All personal property was evaluated and taxed. All personal property. Footstools, footballs, fielder's mitts, egg beaters, everything. The evaluating was done by a specter called the assessor, who came to call like the raven and stared with bleak, unblinking eyes. What was even more deadly was that the assessor was appointed from among the neighborhood itself. Brother against brother, hand to hand, the eternal war of state versus man was waged. Every 2 years or so, the lines were drawn. Very few people actually paid the taxes, and there were always rumors of impending doom. Brown envelopes arrived in mailboxes periodically, throwing panic into murky kitchens, but few actually paid. Nonetheless, the assessor came, with clipboard and ruthless eye. Year after year, the forms were filled, the arid, flat envelopes hidden away in dresser drawers, unopened, while the tiny cancer of fear grew heavier and heavier, and then waned as no lightning bolt from the State House appeared and life went on. The assessor, however, produced some stark moments of truth. A knock on the door, a hush while my mother crept through the living room to peek between the curtains, a strangled whisper, the assessor, for crying out loud, quick, unplug the radio, take it down to the coal bin, hurry up. More than one four-year-old kid was crushed under a refrigerator that was being quickly grappled down the back stairs into the basement. My mother, after the first shock, hissed, don't open your trap. Don't say a word, either of you. Do you understand? Not a word. In came the assessor, scanning our worn oriental rug as he nodded curtly and began to put a price on our world. How old is that rug? How long have you had that umbrella stand made out of the hollowed foot of an elephant? How much did it cost? New, that is, huh? I don't have that bridge lamp on last year's list. New, eh? How much is that flexible flyer over there worth? All over the house, room after room, closet after closet they went, my mother keeping up a running counterpoint. Why, it's just an old thing. My sister was going to throw it out, and I just thought I'd bring it home. Didn't cost anything. We got that old refrigerator at the Salvation Army. Burns out all the time, makes a funny noise. This is the first time in months that it stopped making that funny noise. Sounds pretty good to me. Sounds good. I can't understand it. Why, we can't even sleep when it's going. We're thinking of giving it away. It's why it's not worth $4 we paid for it. What a jip, $4. Sounds pretty good. He made a note on his clipboard, smiled thinly, and moved on. He never even bothered to remove his lumpy gray hat. We had a prop radio that we showed the assessor every time he came. Our real radio, with the magnificent Gothic cathedral cabinet, was lurking under piles of old tires in the basement. We showed him an old battery set that Uncle Tom had had and was a surplus apparently from the Civil War. It had received some of the very first messages that Marconi had tapped out using a magnetized railroad spike and Edison jars. My mother extolled its virtues. Well, it's a sentimental friend of the family, but it's our radio. It uses dry cells. It has a propeller on the side that's wind-driven. Since the creek dried up, the battery don't work. We get nothing but whistles, but my husband likes it, our old radio. That's a genuine Crosley bandbox. Beautiful carved cabinet there. Bird's eye oak, eh? Looks hand-rubbed. Well, look at the back where the mice ate out the back here. See, I stick this Sears Roebuck catalog behind it so nobody can see it. She banged the cabinet hollowly, hoping it would crack. Another enigmatic smile. And then the rug. Say, it's not a bad-looking rug you have there. Oriental, isn't it? Now, wait a minute. Look, here's the place where the hole was burned, where Uncle Carl dropped his pipe and burnt the hole in here. See where the beer was spilled? She moved the rickety, moth-eaten, overstuffed davenport back to show him the place where she tried to hide from the rest of the world. Well, they could fix that. A couple of dollars, they'll reweave that like nothing. That's Oriental, isn't it? He plucked at the fringe, fingering it appreciatively like a connoisseur of fine linens and tapestries, or an Armenian rug dealer coming across a rare find. My mother's panic rose. That's a nice picture up there. Look at that, a sailboat, isn't it? It's a lovely picture. It's an original, isn't it? My mother fended off this blow. Original, my foot, that's original Woolworth. On it went. My mother systematically degrading our lives by simply telling the truth. She invented nothing. Before the assessor came, we always pretended that the holes in the rug didn't exist, and the picture wasn't an original Woolworth. The refrigerator, not a crummy piece of tin that soured milk and curdled cream. Here she was, laying it down, the truth. And I'm hearing it. I am hearing it. A kid who loved his home and the things in it. No, Ma, it's our refrigerator. It has great ice cubes. And our great rug, I lay on it and I follow the pattern with my eyes. It's a beautiful rug with gold fringe. Ma, it's not a terrible rug. Finally, the assessor closed his book. Well, that's it. You're not doing too bad. His feet dragged over our threadbare carpet, the worn linoleum, and into the cold for another 2 years. The assessor had come and gone. A few hours later, my father got the full report as he breezed in through the kitchen door, smelling of the outside in the office. What's new? The assessor was here. What? He stopped in his tracks, his face suddenly white. The assessor was here. The yellow light bulb grew dimmer. The refrigerator sighed deeply, going into action with a squeak of the pulley and a thump of the compressor. The floor shook. Over the roar, my father shouted, Who was it? That's that tall, thin man who lives in the brick house on the other side of the Schwartz's, around the back, over the garage. Oh, I've seen him around. He slowly removed his overcoat and plumped down in the one kitchen chair that was not broken somewhere, somehow. Did you get the radio in the coal bin before he got in? Yep. You think he saw it down there? I don't know. He looked in the coal bin. There was a terrible fear that somehow somebody would get the impression that we live like human beings. What's for supper? Meatloaf. Gradually the chill thawed. Finally it faded out completely as the months went by. And then, out of the blue, without so much as a murmur, of thunder on the horizon, the hammer fell. It was a crackling, sunny, clear-eyed Friday afternoon. Our mosquito swarm of kids slowly worked its way toward home, kicking, hollering, throwing stuff, looking for junk, drifting like rain through the alleys, over fences, under porches, down innumerable shortcuts. Schwartz, Flick, Alex, Junior Kissel, me, and a covey of lesser satellites. At last we reached the block, ready to rush into individual houses, grab some graham crackers or fig newtons, and out the back doors to begin whatever game was being played at the moment in time. Throwing rocks was an important way of getting home. Rocks were thrown at a regular established set of targets. Mrs. Schaefer's birdhouse, Pulaski's Coca-Cola sign, and every telephone pole that got in our way. Our arms were sharp and rubbery, and the rocks bounced and clanged. Every night, the sparrows, robins, and wrens ducked and dodged, squawking raucously, urging us on, taunting, a barrel rolling and skittering through the ambient air amid a hail of whizzing clinkers. Occasionally, a lucky shot shattered an insulator high up amid the crisscrossing tangle of telephone wires, and then a frenzied roar of flight up the alley out of the danger zone. Particularly delectable were the posters that festooned fence posts, garages, and telephone poles. Fat-faced seekers of county office were constantly peppered with a steady barrage of anything that could be picked up and hurled. Watch me get that old Congress. Corngrass. That's old Corngrass. Watch me get him in the air. Zizz. Flonk. Oh, man, what a lucky shot. Lucky, that's the third night in a row I got him. Lucky, watch this. Sizz, thunk, bonk. Another blow for anarchy was struck. Old Corngrass had run for mayor for as long as anyone could remember, each year using the same stolid, toad-like portrait, hair precisely parted with a thin, naked line down the middle of his skull, rimless glasses gleaming dully before beady, staring eyes. He never made it. Maybe because he was so easy to hit with rocks. Now we were on home turf. Hey, watch me get that red one. Zizz. The rock whistle past a new red cardboard poster. Small, compact, with no picture. Zizz. Whoosh. Three projectiles simultaneously bracketed the target. All missed. We drifted idly toward the telephone pole, unaware of the disaster that was about to strike us all. Flick arched an apple core toward the sign. It splattered on the post a few inches high. Schwartz slanted a bottle cap upward, curving nicely, trailing after a passing blue jay who yawked disdainfully and continued on. I don't know who read it first. Maybe we all did. Black print on red poster card. Quote, Sheriff Sale. To be sold at auction tomorrow at 11 a.m. on the premises at 8745 Cleveland Street, the goods and total chattels of Ludlow L. Kissel of that address will be auctioned at sheriff's sale, the sum realized to defray defaulted personal property taxes. The sale will be public, commencing at 11 a.m. by order of the assessor's office, Bureau of Taxation, State of Indiana. That was all. But it was enough. None of us had ever seen a sign like this before, but our instincts, deep and animal-like, told us that it was serious, a dangerous sign. Other dangerous signs showed up from time to time on front porches and screen doors. Quarantined, diphtheria, scarlet fever, smallpox. This was one of those, but different, somehow worse. The neighborhood was unusually quiet, we noticed for the first time. Flick dropped a rock at his feet with a hollow clunk. Junior Kissel, without a word, turned and ran, cutting across the street, up the sidewalk, disappearing toward his house. Halfway down the block, another identical sign gleamed in the bright sunshine. Schwartz, in an odd, scared voice, broke the silence. "What's an auction?" "I don't know. It's some kind of a card game or something," Flick answered. "Maybe it's like on a radio, that Lucky Strike auctioneer," Schwartz said. "I don't think so," I said. We broke up and headed for home through the quiet, hushed neighborhood. My mother was down in the basement wringing out the wash in the gray, murky gloom, the concrete floor around her wet and flecked with patches of dank soap suds. The old Thor washing machine muttered as it squeezed the clammy water from overalls, pillowcases, and house dresses. Her face was red from the steam and soap as she bent over the basket, twisting each garment for the final drops. Weak sunlight filtered in through the narrow basement ground-level windows, fading out in the perpetual dark of the basement. "Ma, what's an auction?" She straightened up, never missing a beat, as she snaked a long, heavy bedsheet through the rubber rollers. "What's a what?" "What's an auction, Ma?" "An auction?" "Yeah, what's an auction?" "Why?" She was talking in her half-hearing, hardly listening, working, answering silly questions, mother voice. "Well, Ma, there's a sign over on the telephone pole that says they're going to have an auction at Mr. Kissel's house. The sheriff is going to be there." The sheet squished on for what seemed like a long time. Suddenly, she reached over quickly, snapping off the washer with a movement that she'd used for years. The basement was deadly still. She turned and looked right at me. Her voice sounded strange. "What did you say? What was that? What are you talking about?" "Well, Ma, there's a sign on the telephone post that says they're having an auction at Mr. Kissel's house with the sheriff, and it says..." Now I was scared. She rushed up the basement stairs, wiping her hands on her apron as she went. "Don't leave the house until I get back." She was gone, out the back door. I was alone in the kitchen now, looking out of the window over at the Kissel house, where she had gone. Another lady, tall, skinny Mrs. Anderson, crossed the alley and disappeared into the house. No kids played in the yard. No radios were turned on, as they always were. My kid brother came up through the back door into the kitchen where I stood on tiptoes, watching the Kissel house. "What's wrong?" he said. "I don't know. Ma said not to go out." He said nothing more. Finally, after what seemed like hours, she came into the kitchen and, without saying a word, began making supper. That night we ate quickly. Almost immediately after, the dishes were washed and we were sent to bed. And for the first time in a long while, there was not the usual protesting uproar. Late that night, I could hear my mother and father talking in low tones in the living room through the closed door until I fell asleep. Somehow, the sun always shines on Saturdays in Indiana. Outside the bedroom window, a yelling crowd of Spatsies, the generic kid name for sparrows, argued, swore, made clattering love. Out in the kitchen, water ran, pots banged. At first, when the full, delicious impact swept over me that it was Saturday, no school today, blessed, fantastic Saturday, and that this afternoon Flick and Junior and I would ride the range with Roy Rogers and Trigger at the Orpheum, I reached over in ecstasy, belted my brother in the ribs, ready for action. He groaned almost at the same time that I remembered something funny was going to happen today. I got up and padded into the kitchen where breakfast was already on the table. The old man, dressed in his Saturday clothes, was halfway through his eggs. Drifting through the kitchen window from somewhere outside came the roar of a truck motor backing and shifting. My mother, over near the sink, looked out. "They're here." My father dropped his fork, circled the table, and peered from the other window. I stood on tiptoes. At an angle almost filling the whole of their sandy, weedy backyard stood a tall, gray, official-looking truck behind the Kissel's house. Men in overalls moved in and out the back door, carrying boxes and barrels. Already piled high in the sunlight, warped, cracked, and stained with the chewing of the years, stood the Kissel furniture. The men struggled under loads.
Well, that's interesting. Stand by while we attempt to fix this.
Chapter 28. From the basement to the attic, from the garage to the kitchen. The sheriff drove up in a black Ford with a white star on the door and got out. He didn't look like a movie sheriff at all, being fat and wearing a long grayish overcoat. He really looked more like a dentist than a sheriff. He had two men with him. One, a tall, thin, red-faced man with eyes that popped, who began making a list in a notebook. The other set up a kind of platform behind the back porch. It folded and looked as if it had been used. One of the workmen brought out a microphone and hooked up a leatherette-covered speaker on the ground near the truck. We watched from behind the geraniums. From behind geraniums all over the neighborhood, other eyes watched. Strange people began arriving in dented blue cars, panel trucks, some just walking, carrying baskets and bags. They were the first auction followers we had ever seen. There is a race of human vulture that lives off the disaster and defeat of others, picking the bones clean. They perform a necessary function, just as any scavenger does. Those on the scene early were rummaging through the piles of coffee pots, old tires, potted ferns, and Mr. Kissel's toolbox, which he carried to the roundhouse on the few days he worked every month. "There's Mr. Kissel's bottle capper," I said, breaking the silence in the kitchen. "Yeah," my father answered, continuing to stare into the bright sunshine. Mr. Kissel made home brew, and when we played in Junior Kissel's basement, we always fooled around with his bottle capper, capping bottles of water, pretending we were bootleggers. Now, the bottle capper lay in the yard next to Mrs. Kissel's old Hoover vacuum cleaner. Old furniture, under the light of a bright sky, seems more tired and worn than anything else I know. In an eerie way, more human, too. The crowd was getting bigger by the minute. Some carried lunches, others babies. They were excited and anxious for the action to begin. None of the neighbors showed up. At least they weren't in the crowd that pushed and waited around the platform. They were strangers. It doesn't pay for vultures to make friends. My kid brother wanted to go out and join in the fun, but the old man said, "Come on, we'll go out and play catch after the people go. You stay here till after they leave." He was a dedicated catch player. Any time he announced that we were going to play catch, the kids listened and hunted for their mitts. His slider was the best I've ever seen outside of Comiskey Park. The sheriff got up on the platform to begin the proceedings, his voice echoing hollowly among the sagging garage doors, the drooping clotheslines, and the limp wet wash. The auctioneer began with a brass table lamp, the one we used to see through their dining room window with the green shade. It was quickly bought. The crowd moved in excitement as the auctioneer went into high gear. Mrs. Kissel's enamel kitchen table went for 70 cents. Once, my father turned to my mother and said, "I guess they're not home. I don't see them anymore, or anywhere." She didn't answer, but I knew that Junior Kissel wasn't around. Someone bought Grandpa Kissel's World War I helmet, which Mr. Kissel had hung on the inside of the basement door. It was a great thing to play with. I guess someone bought it for their kid. No one wanted the mattress, a lumpy, yellow-stained, blue-striped heirloom that had come down from Mrs. Kissel's parents and that had seen the raising of 10 kids. It lay under the truck bed, shoved out of the way, while the more valuable items were bartered off. Rusty saws, an old single-barreled 12-gauge shotgun that brought $4, a spectacular oil tablecloth with red ornamental lettering, a Century of Progress, Chicago's World Fair, with the gold picture of the Hall of Science. The bidding for this one was sharp and bitter. Finally, it was over. It didn't last long, maybe 45 minutes or so, but when it was over, the end was definite. The sheriff got up and announced that the auction was now officially completed. He mentioned an address where another was scheduled in a day or two, on the west side of town. The people got back into their cars, trucks, station wagons, and left as quickly as they'd come, loaded down with their loot. Without confusion or hesitation, the men and the sheriff packed away their gear like a well-practiced team and were gone. All that remained in the backyard was a jumble of lunch bags, pop bottles, chicken bones, crushed cartons, empty barrels, and the mattress. By now, it was almost lunchtime. I was getting hungry. My mother, watching the final truck disappear, said, "Oh, well." The old man went down into the basement to get his glove for the game of catch. Later that afternoon, someone said that the Kissels had gone to Lowell, a town a few miles away, to spend the weekend with Mrs. Kissel's brother-in-law and sister. They never came back. Somewhere, along about the middle of the next week, a for-rent sign appeared on the Kissels' front door. Not long afterward, a new family moved in. We never saw Junior Kissel again. Chapter 29, The Posse Rides Again. I glanced at my stainless steel Rolex, noting that it was getting along towards 4 o'clock, shift change time. I could see that Flick was showing the tenseness of a man about to swing into action. "I'll tell you one thing," Flick said. "I keep up with the bills. I don't owe nobody." "Just a minute. I'll be right back." He moved on down the bar, checking the ammunition for the first wave of serious drinkers, which would arrive within the half hour. I looked again at my Rolex. For some reason, I didn't quite recognize it at first as belonging to my arm. To be honest, I wasn't sure that it was even my arm. Somehow, that sleeve and that watch all belonged in New York. Another world. Back there, they probably would not even believe there was such a man as Flick, or Stosh, or Kissel, or Yaki. They'd probably figure I made them all up. I fleetingly thought, maybe I should try to tell Flick about Les Miserables du Frit and Henri, the lascivious head waiter. How could I tell him about the expense account, and how hardly anybody I knew ever paid for anything, ever, and that the vast gravy train they were on considered cash itself to be vaguely insulting and out of date? I figured it was no use. In the booth, the three sheet metal men began hollering at Flick, who looked up from his inventory and yelled back, "Hold your water, for Christ's sake. I got better things to do than feed you bastards all day." The red-faced one, wearing an orange safety helmet, shouted, "Hey, turn on the TV, Flick. Come on, turn it on. What the hell you got it for?" This exchange took place at full voice, since the jukebox was shaking the floor. "I'll turn it on when I'm damn good and ready." I wondered briefly how Flick would get along with Henri, the effete and painfully elegant head waiter who controlled the entire east side of New York. Flick finally reached up and snapped on the switch of the monster color TV set that hung high over the bar mirror. It seemed to warm up instantly. A thundering herd of posse riders roared across the screen. Mr. Clean appeared briefly and disappeared. Again the posse thundered, this time in the opposite direction, their guns roaring above the booming polka. Obviously conversation was out of the question, or at least it had become somewhat hazardous. There's something about TV sets in bars that makes even sane people look at them. I sipped what appeared to be at least my 30th beer of the afternoon, staring upward at a moon-faced cowboy strumming a guitar. Behind him, I could see old familiar country that I knew like the back of my hand. Those Hollywood back lots were as familiar as my backyard when I was a kid. Flick finished his bottle checking, armed himself with a clean bar rag, and stood briefly looking up at another posse, this time roaring directly at us, the puffs of their guns, their square jaws, the flying hoofs blending well with the eternal jukebox. We both watched for a long moment. I seen it. So have I. If I remember correctly, Flick, that fat guy on the left is going to get shot. Just as I said it, the fat guy spun into the air, dying spectacularly, as cowboy extras always do, clutching at the clouds, slipping into the sagebrush, milking his scene as far as he could under union rules. Yep, I seen it. Flick turned back from the set with the air of a man adding a period at the end of a sentence. I, however, continued to stare at the set. It seemed one of those eerie coincidences that happen once in a while that cause ladies who wear tennis shoes to believe in ESP, flying saucers, and swamis. I was not sure whether I should bring it up, else Flick suspected I had had at least one beer too many. I could see he was the kind of bartender who did not serve drunks, but probably tossed them out by the scruff of their neck out into the gale. Flick, I have seen that picture before. Yep, I seen it too, Flick said. You know, I have a feeling, Flick, that I saw it with you. He looked back up at the set for a long moment as though to check his memory. The posse thundered down a ravine, diagonally this time, from left to right. Finally, he said reflectively, by God, I think you're right. It played with Rhythm on the Prairie with Dick Foran. They had Bob Steele in person. We both disappeared briefly into our own dream world, eventually broken by Flick, who said, hey, that was the day that Schwartz threw up in the drinking fountain in the lobby. Correct. That is right. We returned to the posse for a bit. And finally, I had to ask a question that was on my mind ever since the first gunshot. Flick, did Doppler ever show his face around here again? He turned back to me, his expression as grim as any of those hard-faced men riding in that eternal posse, pursuing endless bad guys through the wilds of MGM land. Doppler? His voice snapped like Ken Maynard biting out the name of a sheep rustler. Doppler? He wouldn't dare show up around here. They'd string him up in a minute.
Smooth, huh? Smooth. Okay. Can't decide whether to use Shepherd music or Little Rascal music. Let's go with the silent movie montage. Frequently used by Mr. Shepherd on his radio program in the 1960s. That was Gene Shepherd reading a couple of chapters from his book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. And you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI in New York. 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, on the World Wide Web. And we have had two calls this morning. We need to do much better than that. That reading, I apologize. You know, the last time I attempted to play that, I realized that the program had scrambled the audio, and I redubbed it. So I hope I picked it up roughly where we left off from the other copy. We heard two chapters from In God We Trust. Nevermore, quoth the assessor, nevermore, the story of WBAI, as the assessor comes to haul away all of our goods, which is why we're having this emergency fund drive. And the next chapter, one of the stringer intermediary chapters, the posse rides again, as Shepherd's alter ego sits in Flick's tavern, recounting the old days before he moved to the big city. And the whole book reading is about 8 hours long. It covers seven CDs. You can have it for a $125 pledge. WBAI, the complete In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. Originally published October 1966 and read in 1969, January or February, as I recall. And totally unavailable. I happened upon it from someone who must have been in the studio as it was being assembled, because he managed to get a cassette copy from the master tape. That's what we've got for you here. Unfortunately, yes, that cassette copy is a cassette copy, circa 1969, so the sound quality is what you heard there, plus a little cleanup, but nonetheless, it's Shepard in his prime reading his own book, which includes such stories as Duel in the Snow, or Red Rider Nails the Cleveland Street Kid, which turned into a Christmas story. You got the story of the counterfeit Secret Circle member gets the message, or the Asp strikes again. The endless streetcar ride into the night, and the tinfoil noose. It's the blind date story. Harry Gertz and the 47 Crappies. My Old Man and the Lascivious special award that heralded the birth of pop art. That's the leg lamp story. All of these included in your $125 reading of In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. The Magic Mountain, going to the World's Fair, going to Magic Mountain. Grover Dill and the Tasmanian Devil. Ludlow Kissel and the Dago Bomb That Struck Back, the 4th of July story. Uncle Ben and the Side-Splitting Knee Slapper, or Some Wounds Are Loaded, or Some Words Are Loaded, I should say. Old Man Pulaski and the Infamous Jawbreaker Blackmail Caper. The Perfect Crime. Wilbur Duckworth and the Magic Baton, the story of the marching band. Miss Brayfogle and the Frightening Case of the Speckle-Throated Cuckold, the book review that young Mr. Shepard wrote and handed in, not knowing what the book was that he had read. The story that we just heard. And Leopold Doppler and the Great Orpheum Gravy Boat Riot. So these are among the stories, plus all the intervening chapters on 7 CDs for $121 pledge. How do you get it? You call 212-209-2950 and pledge your support to WBAI and to this program, Mass Backwards. We also have our $30 CD of 22 NPR commentaries from 1983. Gene Shepard for 6 months or so, maybe a little longer, did a regular weekly feature on All Things Considered. And apparently they were gathered up probably for a premium for NPR once upon a time. That seems to be the source of these 22 commentaries. A little over an hour. You'll get it all for a $30 pledge to WBAI. 212-209-2950. We have had two pledges so far this morning. We'll listen to more of those NPR segments in a short period of time. We'd like to get another call or two in here. 212-209-2950. There's a call. Thank you for that call. We can take another one. We'd like to thank Mark Dickey of Manhattan for his pledge and John Lyon for his pledge. Those are our two pals this morning. We'd like to count you in the inner circle. Here's the secret message. G22, H13, B7. You got it so far? That means dial 212, a crummy commercial. Dial 212-209-2950 and make a pledge of support to WBAI. If you're already a member, why not throw us another $25, huh? We're doing this now. Ordinarily, we do a little shorter summer thing in August to tide us over and catch up on some bills, but the need was so urgent and so great that we had to bring it a little earlier this year and a little longer this year, because we need to make $200,000, largely make up the shortfall from the May fundraising drive. And so if you fail to make a contribution in May, if you're listening now, give us a call, 212-209-2950. If you're listening to this on tape from one of the archives at BAI.org or perhaps the FlickLives.com website, you can pledge online at WBAI.org. You can't miss it. They've covered up the whole page with a pitch message while the drive continues. Our goal is $200,000, and mercifully, we're more than halfway there. But each and every penny counts at this point. And as a member of the Finance Committee, I can state with not great authority that the more money we make in this drive, the more money we can stick in our budget for next year. Which, finally, fiscal responsibility comes in WBAI. We can't budget more for next year than we actually make in money this year. So, as I say, the more money we make this year, the less cuts we'll have to make next year on projected income figures. But it will take more than the one caller who is on the line now. It will take you, and you, and you, to call with a pledge of support, however big, however small. Now, I know times are rough. The economy sucks. We heard the mayor on the news today talking about the city is belt-tightening projects, but he said, no, we're not going to cut culture. We'll find a way to pay for it. We're not going to make the mistake we made in the 70s, quoth the mayor, of cutting garbage collection and essential services, education, or culture and arts. We will have to find a way to pay for it. Well, that's the way it is here at WBAI, too. Unfortunately, the only way we have to pay for it is to come on the air and ask our listeners for it. Unlike subscription services like your satellite radio, for example, where you pay up front, where they cut off your service. We're on the honor system at WBAI. We pump out the great radio, and then we come and ask you to pay for it. And that's what we're doing now, reminding you that WBAI costs money, lots and lots of money, several million dollars a year to operate, and 90% of it comes from our listeners, of which you are one, because you are listening. But only 1 in 10 of you who are listening ever make a pledge. So it's your turn now. You, the 9 out of 10 who never call and support the radio station that you tune to, it's your turn now to call and make a pledge. I see we've taken in another $25. Thank you so much. That's the basic membership rate. We also are offering the Gene Shepherd CD of an hour of commentaries, 22 radio commentaries from NPR for a $30 pledge, or the complete reading of In God We Trust, All Others Can Pay Cash, read by Gene Shepherd himself in 1969, utterly unavailable, something people have long sought after. Well, I found a copy of it. We're offering it to you here exclusively for a pledge of $125 to 7-CD set. 7 CDs, 8 hours, the complete book read by the author himself. For a mere $125 pledge, all of the money goes to support WBAI. I make them myself. I charge the station nothing. It's my donation, my major donation, in order to try to convince a few of you to make a pledge. 212-209-2950. We're on the air for another 22 minutes. We've had 3 callers this morning. I'd like to see 3 more. Starting with you. You, right there. That's right, you. You, sticking your head back under your pillow. No, no, get up. Go to the telephone, take out your credit card, and call us. 212-209-2950. Pledge your support for the program you tune into religiously, faithfully, every week. No, you've got to help pay for it. 212-209-2950. Oh, thank you. There's a call. We've hit the bank of phones that have bells attached. Well, all right. Now, if you'd like to hear your bell, 212-209-2950. There's one caller on the line. Can we get a second call? $125 for the complete reading of In God We Trust. $30 for the 22 NPR commentaries. Now, wait a second. What happened to our music? That couldn't have been all of the music, could it? All right, to hell with music. Let's find another commentary. Here's one. Let's listen to Shepherd's salute to a radio great. This one's longer than most of the commentaries. This one runs almost 6 minutes long. Done at approximately the time that Arthur Godfrey passed away. Shepard, salute to that radio legend, Arthur Godfrey. My mother listened every day. And that radio on in the kitchen. Two callers on the line. Well, okay. Well, we're going to listen to the Godfrey. Because there's only one guy back there answering calls. Please be patient. We will get to all of your calls. If I have to, I'll just put on music and go answer them myself. Why not? I do everything else around here. Here's Gene Shepard talking about Arthur Godfrey. This is Math Backwards, WBAI, New York.
Someone once described Arthur Godfrey's voice this way. It's like a south wind blowing over a swamp full of dirty old bathtubs. And it was a voice millions of us came to know and to trust. He was the first to come into our homes as a friend. Godfrey was the first to just talk on the radio. He'd figured out that if two people were in a room together, they'd be talking to each other and not listening to him. Arthur Godfrey died yesterday in New York City. He was 79. He'd been off the air for about 20 years, winning a fight with lung cancer, but losing fights with the networks about returning to television or radio. For Gene Shepard, an all things considered commentator and radio veteran, Arthur Godfrey was a breakthrough performer, and that, according to Shepard, puts him in pretty good company.
There was a writer in the 19th century who was a breakthrough writer by the use of his language, by the use of his attitude, and by the use of his the general beat and tempo of his work, and that was Mark Twain. Mark Twain was the first writer to break out of the 19th century matrix of writing. He was the first modern writer, really. You read Mark Twain today and he's alive. Well, Godfrey would be, in my book, the first modern media man, the first modern broadcaster.
You know, I don't remember, I'm realizing, radio before Arthur Godfrey. I remember Arthur Godfrey talking to me there in the kitchen, coming from wherever he was coming from, but I don't remember what radio was like just before he was on.
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't think many people do, because radio before Godfrey was eminently forgettable. It was like, seriously, he created a medium that you listened to. You listened to Godfrey. You didn't just have it on. You see, prior to Godfrey's work, as far as I can tell, historically, the whole concept of radio was basically, ladies and gentlemen, you know, there's this vast audience out there. Whereas Godfrey really created what we call today the modern style in broadcasting.
The television talk shows of today could be traced back to Godfrey.
Well, only Paley, if I may use William Paley's name. Godfrey had so much more juice in his work. Obviously today, you know, most of the talk shows that are on television are all based on showbiz. So you'll hear Johnny Carson endlessly telling jokes about this guy at Las Vegas and that guy at Las Vegas and the usual California jokes and so on. Whereas Godfrey didn't do that, you know. His humor was more about life itself. He had an underlying sardonic view of things, and it came through. Years ago, when I was on late night radio myself, Godfrey had an apartment in Manhattan, and Godfrey used to call me. The phone would ring, and he'd say, "Godfrey here." And he'd say, "Well, you weren't bad tonight, Shepard." I'd say, "Thanks, Mr. Godfrey." He said, "That's right, it's Mr." And he'd hang up. He was truly a puckish character. I'll make one other comment about Godfrey and his style. There were a lot of people that couldn't believe what they were hearing when they first heard Godfrey. Very controversial, by the way, I might add.
That style, you mean?
Well, not only his style, but his content. Underlying Godfrey's work, a lot of times, there was all kinds of blue material. Don't forget, he'd been a sailor. He'd been around. He was not Mr. Nice Guy. And underneath it all, Godfrey did not hesitate to let you know there were things like sex in the world. Guys drank. There were fistfights in bars. All kinds of things nobody talked about. And Godfrey was sitting there laughing, and you knew that Godfrey had tried them all. Mm-hmm. So he had, let's put it this way, he had blood.
I get deeply personally involved in everything. And I've enjoyed every minute of it. All I can say to you all now is thanks, stay well and happy, and I'll be seeing you.
Seems like old times, having you to walk with. Seems like old times, having you to talk with. And it's still a thrill just to have my arms around you. Still the thrill that it was the day I found you. Seems like old times, dinner dates and flowers, just like old times, staying up for hours, making dreams come true, doing things we used to do. Seems like old times, being here with you.
It's all.
Band for you. The Saints Go Marching In. A little Shepherd background music. We've had two more callers. Tally's up to $205. I'd like to double that before we go off the air. I'd like to thank Alex Offord of Brooklyn and Kevin Vincent of I'm not sure where, because I didn't actually bring his pledge card in. What we're offering this morning, that Arthur Godfrey piece was one of 22 commentaries by Gene Shepherd produced for National Public Radio in 1983. You can get them all on one CD for a $30 pledge to WBAI. Or our higher-end pledge for $125, a complete reading by the author himself of his own work of In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. Gene Shepherd's first book, first novel, first collection of short stories, call it what you will, read in 1969 by Gene Shepherd, and totally lost and totally unavailable except right here as a premium for $125 pledge to WBAI. So take your choice and get the Just Happy to Help $20 or $30 premium of the 22 NPR commentaries, or the Oh Boy, I Always Wanted to Read This Book, $125 pledge for the complete reading of In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, on seven CDs. It's about 8 hours long altogether, and it is yours with a pledge for a pledge of $125 to WBAI. Attention, Mounts, as time runs out, there is one caller on the line. Will you join that caller? We also need volunteers. We're at 120 Wall Street on the 10th floor. And at the moment, the only person here answering the phones is our tally person. We thank him so much. God bless him for being here. But if you would like to come keep him company and help out the radio station, you know, if you work for 3 hours, that's the same as a $25 pledge. If you need to become a member but somehow at the moment can't afford to make a pledge, sweat equity, they call it. You work for your pledge. Put in 3 hours answering phones. If you put in more time, I forget how many hours you need to accumulate, but we offer premiums for, I think, 15 hours. So if you can work, five different three-hour shifts, you can get one of the premiums that we offer here on the radio. And, you know, you can not only answer phones, but I've seen some of our volunteers mailing out premiums, too. And if you're waiting for a premium, they're coming. We're painfully aware of the backlog of premiums, and we are working diligently to get them out. Now, this $30 CD disc of the NPR commentaries, that's ready to go. You'll pledge for it. It'll be on its way. Especially if you use a credit card. We urge you to pledge by credit cards. There's a lot less paperwork, and we get the money much quicker. You pledge on a credit card, you won't have to think about it again. You won't have to write a check. You won't have to, we won't have to send out reminder notices. And, just that easy, just that quick. 212-209-2950. Join the caller on the line. I want you to stay tuned. 6 o'clock, Anthony Sloan will be participating in Wake Up Call, and I believe we will be hearing more of the articles of impeachment as read by, on the floors and the halls of Congress by Dennis Kucinich. 35 good reasons why this president should go. And not, we shouldn't wait until the election to do it either. Yes, 35 good reasons why the president is a criminal who should be removed from office. You're not going to hear that on your Fox News. You're not going to hear that on your NBC News. You're only going to hear that at your community listener-sponsored radio station, WBAI. A lot of good programming coming up for the fun drive later today. Oh, I have too many windows open here. Where's my browser? Okay, let's just have a look at what's in today's lineup at WBAI. Well, the computer's frozen. Isn't that nice? It's doing too much, trying to play audio and browse the web at the same time. Ah, here it is, Tuesday at 10:30 this morning till noon, Protesting Power, a David Occhiuto special. David does wonderful programs with war veterans and peace issues and environmental issues. And today, both local and mass nonviolent actions against U.S. administration policies that violate basic principles of international law, the United States Constitution, and human rights are legitimate acts of civil resistance and crime prevention. In Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and the Law, author Francis Boyle provides legal and constitutional arguments to support and defend civil resistance activities. That's today at 10:30 after Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman at 9 o'clock, which follows Wake Up Call, which follows in about 9 minutes. Okay, we've had another $25 pledge. Or was it $30? I can't do the math. We'd like to play one or two more commentaries from the NPR disc that's available for a $30 pledge, but we need you to join the caller on the line. We seem to have another caller, so that's another pledge. Two premiums this morning, brand new, never before offered. The NPR 22 commentaries on one CD disc for a $30 pledge, or the 7-CD complete reading of In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, by Gene Shepherd, read by the author in 1969, for a $125 contribution to WBAI. Those are the premiums we're offering. And this summer emergency fund drive is just that, an emergency. The more money we can raise in the next 4 days, the fewer people will be taking unpaid vacations from the staff of WBAI. That's what it's come to. Once again, it's come to staff taking the hit because us on-air staff can't get enough of you listeners to help pay the freight. You know, if you want the radio that you've come to expect from WBAI, you really need to take it upon yourself, your responsibility to support the radio station that you listen to. There's no other way to put it. It's just that simple. You need to support the radio that you listen to. And if you find WBAI an invaluable resource, broadcasting as we do things that you just can't get on any other outlet, 212-209-2950. It's as simple as that. And we have had 5 or 6 people pledging this morning, which is good. But we could have 5 or 6 more in the next 5 minutes. Actually, we have 6 minutes. Now, are we going to have time for one more commentary? Or am I going to have to spend the rest of the time cajoling and pleading and begging and asking and imploring for you to do your duty? Take responsibility. 212-209-2950. And in exchange, we will give you a lovely hour of Gene Shepard lost material. $30 for the 22 commentaries from NPR from 25 years ago. I think they used it as a premium once, but you can't get them anymore. The $125 premium is the 7-CD reading of In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. We played you two stories from that already. And that's a mere fraction of what you get in that premium package. It's over 8 hours long on 7 CDs. That is also unavailable anywhere, anyhow. You can't buy it. You can't download it. You can't steal it. Well, you probably could steal it, but that's the only way you could get it. Nowhere but right here at WBAI for a $125 contribution. But time's a-wasting. We're off the air in 5 minutes. We need to hear from more of you. Join the caller on the line. Wake-up call on its way. I'd like to get, 305. Oh, that's more than, that's 100 more than the last time I looked. Okay. We could use one more call like that. Would be nice to get up to $400. Next week, of course, we return with regular programming, no pitching. We'll be back to a regular schedule next week. This all ends on Saturday. But if you can help out answering the telephones, mailing premiums, we got all kinds of work for folks who want to come up, take a look at the radio station and help out. Mainly answering phone calls anytime, 24 hours a day between now and, sometime Saturday afternoon. 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. Call ahead, though, so we can enter you into the computer system. This morning would be a fine time. Maybe around 7. That would be an excellent time. We always need volunteers in the early morning hours because the staff doesn't get up and get in that early. This overnight, we had no volunteers. So tomorrow, you know, you might be the only person back here, you and Tally. I'll personally give you a tour of the radio station if you can volunteer overnight tomorrow. I'll introduce you to Reggie as he performs his wonderful program from the soundboard.
Yeah.
What do you got tomorrow, or is it a surprise?
I'm thinking of something from
Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa. Well, you know, those are some rare performances. And Frank Zappa did record a lot of his own stuff. See, I was doing this earlier. Somebody said, is this from the soundboard?
That would be.
Yeah.
It definitely would be.
Oh, you know.
Actually, I do have something.
Where is this one, by the way? Where did I put this CD? Is this it? Because I want to hear before I go out, before we urge you one last time to join the last caller on the line, I want to listen to, okay, just the most incredible vocal performance you've ever heard. I wish I could loop it. I should have dubbed it off and looped it earlier. All right, we'll put it up low in the background. When we get to it, you'll know it. I don't know how vocal cords do this. Will you call now and support WBAI in our last 2 minutes of Mass Backwards? Gene Shepard premiums are available. $30 gets you a CD. Oh, oh. We'll fade out the little rascals. Okay, here we go. Hey, not yet. I just want a loop of that. Play it until you're inspired to go to the telephone. 212-209-2950. With 90 seconds to go, that same caller on the line. So I guess we have no one else wants to pledge. $125 for that Gene Shepard complete reading of In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. Utterly unavailable, except with your pledge. $30 for the NPR 22 commentaries by Gene Shepard from 1983. A full hour, more than an hour, including the Arthur Godfrey that we just heard, also including Car Names, rehearsing for a job as a cop, The Pickle Lovers Organization, Slob Appeal, Spring Fever, TV news reruns. Just some of the titles. The Concrete Mexican that we heard earlier. Concrete White Castle Burgers, Cookbooks by Famous Writers, Howard Johnson's Old Time Radio. Just some of the subjects covered on the hour-long CD for a $30 pledge. 212-209-2950. I'm Max Schmid. Thanks to the people who have called. If you get around to it in the next 10 minutes, maybe you're brushing your teeth or doing something else requiring the use of all your hands, you can call a little later on. Anytime between now and Saturday, actually, 212-209-2950 to pledge your support to WBAI and our Summer Emergency Fund Drive, because we really, really need it. We need your help. By the way, Bernard said he was going to be a little bit late.
I kind of figured.
But
that.
I know Anthony Sloan is standing by.
I kind of figured that.
So, should I go on? Should I press on? At 6 o'clock here at WBAI New York, 99.5 FM? There's another call. We got a second caller. Okay, we're gonna get an announcement. But you've got one more minute to take advantage of this premium offer, and then, you know, you'll have to pledge online. I hope that we have it up there for you. It isn't yet. It could be. We'll try to get it there for all of you people listening after the fact. This is WBAI New York. I'm Max Schmid. I'll be back 7 o'clock Sunday night with the Golden Age of Radio. Back to regular programming. Full 2 hours of stuff. But right now, we say goodbye to Janis Joplin, 1968, and say hello to some ridiculous announcement from your friendly radio station.